Ken Mia.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Potoka.
No, please, please.
Thanks. I want to thank Ken Mia and the Writers' Center for asking me to introduce Lynn Leskatoff, who I don't know, but who, after reading the book, I feel like I do know, and I wasn't really sure why Henry had asked me to introduce you, but he knows that I love basketball, follow basketball, and also, oh yes, thank you, and also that I've read a lot of sports books. I've read a lot of books on sports, and it turns out that I've never read a book like this, and it has to do with the fact that it's written from the perspective of somebody who is the spouse of a professional athlete. And it gives these very amazing behind-the-scenes looks at people that, you know, you hold in, well, we have them up on pedestals and we make statues out of them, and we come to find out after reading the book that they do have feet of clay. And so that in and of itself is astounding. Lynn, and I won't, you know, go into the book in great deal other than to tell you that, you know, it's got these great photographs in it. People, you know, playing the sport, you know, it shows the grace and power of people playing the sport. And the book itself is sort of a time capsule of what life was like in the 50s and 60s here in Boston. And Lynn and her husband Jim came from the West Coast to Boston in the 50s and 60s, which was nothing like what we know it as today, if you remember what it was like. I mean, the Customs House was the tallest building in the town, and it was sort of gray and dismal, real backwater, and then to see it develop into what it is today. But when Lynn and Jim came here, you were 20, he was 24, and they're seeing it for the first time through their eyes of these very wonderful young people, and just, you know, taking all of that in. And going to the Boston Garden, meeting Red Auerbach, and negotiating their own contract in the days before agents, you know, just very interesting things that we'd never learn unless, of course, we read the book. Which I thought when I got it, you know, it's like that person who gets the book to review and he writes to the author that I just received your book. I'll waste no time reading it, which can be taken a couple of different ways. But, you know, so here it is. You know, I figured I would give it a sports page read, but as it turned out, it starts out like Donna Reed, but it winds up like Peyton Place. It's amazing. The arc of the story is just amazing, and I was really impressed with the way Lynn did it. She has the introduction by Red Auerbach, who I now believe, after the things that you said in the book, probably didn't read it entirely, because Lynn has some very hard-hitting critiques about the people behind the scenes, the people, the relationships between men and women in that time period, the relationships between professional athletes, players and coaches. And so, you know, I wrote down that, you know, behind every great man is an exhausted woman could be the subtitle of this marvelous book. So in any event, Lynn is an accomplished artist. Some of her work is here tonight, and she's written other books in the past, and I brought my pen and my basketball in the hopes that I can get her to autograph it right now before your very eyes.
All right, Lynn, well, let's get a photo then. Hold
on. I'd be happy to do that. Okay, let's see. You know, the other day, someone called me for something or other, and Jim said, "I think now you're the celebrity."
I think so.
But if he saw this, he'd be really annoyed, I think.
I know.
That's going a little too far. Well, I'll let you do
it. Very
that.
Good. Okay, folks, please welcome Lynn Leskatoff.
All right. Thank you. Well, that was the most wonderful introduction. I don't know if there's anything else I have to say. anyway, but I do. I will. And I will maybe shorten it a bit because, now most of you have a book. But anyway, this is how it all started. My husband, Jim, burst through the door of the finance company where I worked in Eugene, Oregon. Startled, I jumped from my desk chair. Why was he here? Was something wrong? He had on his green University of Oregon Ducks basketball warm-ups. I later learned he had jogged 2 miles from campus along Willamette Street to my office. This blonde, muscular giant was winded, sweating, and pulsing with excitement. He waved a piece of paper in my face. "Lynn, the Celtics called." He raised a triumphant fist in the air and shouted, "The Boston Celtics want me." He spun me in a circle and gave me a wild grin. "I'm their first draft choice. I need to call them back today." I knew at once this call would dramatically change our lives. We'd been married for 6 months, and my life already revolved around basketball. This call could mean the realization of a dream for Jim. So that's how that started. And then, well, I'm just going to read you little bits of it here and there. So, at Christmas, Jim, I talk about how we met, which was, it was at a Sunday afternoon jam session, and I was with another girlfriend. I'm just going to paraphrase this part, and I came in the door, and there was this absolute gorgeous, tall, wonderfully tall. I was always tall, and that was a problem sometimes, you know, dating. handsome man. So anyway, he said, "Would you like to dance?" And I said, "Yes, I would like to dance." And so we danced for hours and hours, and then that was the beginning of our relationship. And so, let me see, I had marked all these pages, but I feel like I'm with friends that I don't even have to be so formal. When Jim came to call for me that first day, my mother, I was still getting ready. I was in the bathroom putting on my makeup, and the doorbell rang. It was a Sunday afternoon. We were going for a ride up in the redwoods near our house in River City. So my mother opened the door, and she came in and threw herself in front of the bathroom door and said, "You are not going out with that big man." So, anyway, of course, being the kind of teenager I was, that made it all the more interesting. We were married. Jim was Russian, and his parents really were disappointed that he wasn't marrying a Russian lady. So we ended up having two ceremonies. We had a Russian wedding and a Protestant wedding. And afterwards, I was to drive across country while Jim flew to make the ball club. And of course, I had just barely had a driver's license, you know. And I drove Route 66, which was really fun, interesting, and got to know it very well. But anyway, thinking about everything that had transpired helped to pass the time on my cross-country road trip. But finally, I was now approaching my destination. After 5 exhausting days, I arrived in New York City during the morning traffic rush hour. I was soon terrorized when I realized our yellow Chevrolet looked like a taxi cab. Taxi drivers and other drivers, for that matter, don't appreciate ladies looking mystified while driving down one-way streets. I was yelled at, sworn at, and countless fists and digits were waved at me in obscene gestures. Frantically, I attempted to look at the map. Not possible. The stoplights would change, and I had to move. There was nowhere to pull over. Horns honked, people crossed in front of me. It was a fascinating mass of activity that I couldn't appreciate. I just wanted to arrive at my destination and unscramble my long legs from behind that wheel. At last, I was able to negotiate the one-way streets, and finally, a reasonably agreeable cab driver led me to the Paramount Hotel. By now, Nemo, our dog, was howling desperately. He needed to find a fire hydrant or a tree, and so did I. But we had arrived. I did it. As I pulled up in front and spotted the valet parking attendant, I slammed on the brakes, grabbed Nemo, broke three fingernails trying to turn the door handle, threw the keys to the guy, leapt out of the door, and ran for the lobby. The elevator door opened, and there stood Red Auerbach. My sunglasses were askew, my dog was yelping, and I was ready to cry. And he said to me, "What the hell are you doing here? Wives are not allowed on road trips." So that was how that went. And we never were allowed on road trips. Let's see. Well, Jim was constantly in scuffles, but that was his job. He was supposed to be the enforcer, and he was to protect Bob Cousy and, you know, and pass. Jim still holds records on the West Coast, where he went to school at the University of Oregon, for shooting and rebounding and so on. But when he came to the Celtics, they just wanted him to protect Bob Cousy and Bill Sharman at that time. So that was okay with Jim. He always liked a good fight. So that was the role that he played. He was the enforcer. And and then in 57, the newspapers were full of speculation about a black man who was coming to Boston to play basketball. We had met Rose and Bill Russell in California because we were from California also, and we had met during the summer. But the newspapers were full of speculations about this talented man. As a rookie, when Bill Russell arrived, he received the same tough initiation treatment from the veteran players. They elbowed him, they shoved him, they pummeled, and they generally pounded him. Bill Russell was a defensive player. He said, "My favorite shot is to hold the ball 10 inches above the basket and then drop it in." It was soon obvious he had the ability to catch the opposing team off balance. His gift for converting defense into offense was the blocked shot. He said, "You can't block shots with your feet on the ground." Speculation quickly turned to realization. Could it be the answer for Red's championship aspirations? Could he jump like they said? Was he as strong a center as was rumored? Russell had an attitude, and he didn't care who knew it. His size was tremendous, and his scowl was part of his facial expression. His race intimidated people, and he often used it to keep them away. He became the first public figure to say that Boston was a racist city. He was the only black professional athlete in a city where there were few black professionals anywhere. He was educated, and he was proud. Later, Russell was to write three books about his playing years. In one of them, Go Up for Glory, he talks about his years growing up and how he was influenced by hardships in the South and how he came to be a proud Negro. All through the basketball dynasty that was to come, his greatness and his ability to control a game defensively would become obvious and be acknowledged. That would take a lot of years and a lot of titles. He was to remake the game of basketball for the Celtics and would start a legacy for black men who came into the NBA and every other major professional organization. Later, he was chosen to become the first black coach in the NBA. Bill had an attitude. He would not sign autographs. He was not interested in talking to the press. He was a unique individual, and he was going to be his own man. Red treated him carefully and gave him his lead. He was playing 48 minutes a game, and that's what Red wanted. Bill was to change basketball in Boston. He changed it for the Celtics, and he changed it for all the athletes to come. He played 48 minutes a game. He was brilliant on the floor. He was opinionated and antagonistic. He was outspoken in his demand for privacy and respect. He was angry. He was a new experience for the press, who were accustomed to little milquetoasts like us, who told them whatever they wanted to hear. Bill Russell told them what he felt like saying. He also told them, "I don't like most white people because they are white. Conversely, I like most Negroes because they are black." And he said he was going to invest his earnings in a rubber plantation in Africa. So, in 1957, finally, there were large audiences at the Boston Garden. They used to be like maybe, 300 people, then maybe 500, and maybe 1,000. And their goal was 13,909. But anyway, on May of 1957, a Sunday afternoon, here was the largest total audience that the NBA had ever attracted, especially since the game was nationally televised. The score of the game was close the entire way. A spectacular play by Russell ended the regulation play with a score 103-103. Overtime brought us all to our feet. Unbelievably, that three-minute period finished in another tie, and a second overtime was called. Tension mounted as Russell knocked away what looked like a clear shot. Ramsey shot from 20 feet out and sunk it. But still, the score was now St. Louis 124 to Boston 121. Phillips made a two-point shot on a missed block by Alex Hannum. Hannum tried to hurry the ball back to St. Louis basket, but was called for traveling. He was desperate. He fouled Jim Luskatoff with a second to go. Jim stood at the free throw line, and an almost full house, including me, collectively held our breath as he made the free throw, and the winning score was Boston 125 to St. Louis 124. Boston had its first world championship, and we had just witnessed Jim put in the winning basket. Yes, Boston had just won its first championship. That winning basket gave birth to a dynasty. Every play counted in this game, especially the last one. When I witnessed my husband shooting that free throw for the winning 2 points to claim the first Boston Celtics World Championship. So, that's... however, it was not all glory and great stuff. Jim was injured a couple of times. Once he had knee surgery, and in fact, Red was, helping him to get back to be able to play again. And so he did. He played, and then, but however, after a couple of more years, he had a disc problem. So he had to retire because he felt it was time. Red wanted him to play another year. And Jim and I both thought that since he was injured and, in those days, if you were injured and you left the game, there was no pension or no benefits or no anything. It was goodbye, Charlie, and, good luck to you. So we started thinking about what would happen, after he retired. One of the shots I really like in this book is when Wilt Chamberlain came to Boston. And Well, Jim and Wilt Chamberlain did their share of knocking heads. Well, right here, in fact, I think Chamberlain's giving him a fair shot of some very pointed elbows. Bob Cousy, of course, was Mr. Basketball and was a local person. He was from Worcester, and people loved him here. But Bill Russell used to get really upset because Bob Cousy was getting too much attention as far as he was concerned. But in 62 and 63, Bob announced his retirement. And it was at the Boston Garden, people were crying and they were calling for him to, you know, he was called down on the floor, and it was the longest length of applause you could imagine. But anyway, the next year Jim decided that he would retire. And so we had a night planned for him. A retirement night was planned for Jim. There had been such a big night for Bob Cousy with tears and gifts and recognition for all of his 13 playing years. The night that was planned for Jim would surely be something not to be forgotten. We arranged for a party at the Madison Hotel after the game for our friends who would be attending. We took Holly and Jimmy to watch this special game to honor their dad. I left Carol at home. She was just a few months old, and it would be too difficult to have an infant at the game. During that game, fans and friends filled the garden to recognize Jim's contribution to the Celtics. Walter Brown presented Jim with a grandfather clock, as he had been told that we shared our interest for antiques. Doff Shays, who played for Syracuse and one of Jim's rival opponents during games, was there to give him a plaque and thank him for his years of friendly competition. All through the game, the Celtics led in scoring. Red had not put Jim in the first half, but surely he would play him in the second half. The Celtics had a substantial lead. The starters were being pulled out to rest on the bench, and it looked like an easy win. Red was substituting so that everyone had a chance to play. Everyone but Jim, that was. Red would not put him in the game. Even when the crowd started shouting, "We want Jim, Jim, Jungle Jim," Red looked up at the crowd, lit a cigarette as usual, and ignored everyone. He was in control. He refused to put Jim in the game, even for 2 minutes, so that the fans and friends who had come to witness his retirement celebration could give him a goodbye round of applause. I'll never forgive Red for that act. I have forgiven him for several other things, but keeping Jim out of that final game was not necessary. Anyway, so, how am I doing? Time-wise, I mean.
Yes.
I got you?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Did Russell ever buy a rubber plantation in Africa?
Yes. And he lost a lot of money there. He also bought a restaurant, Slade's it was called, in Boston. And he lost a lot of money there. He wasn't a very good businessman, but anyway. So when Jim was, you know, retiring, in fact, I really enjoyed putting some of these pictures in, because I don't think people could realize this was a party that we had at the Boston Garden with the Bruins and the Celtics every year. And the scorer, Tony Noto, would pick out a gift, age appropriate for all of our kids, and we had a party at the Boston Garden on the ice. Now, the Bruins could skate, and that was great, but the Celtics were not supposed to be, you know, to go on the ice. But anyway, it was such a homey kind of thing. I mean, nowadays, can you imagine, like, some of those teams that that would be their Christmas party? You know, maybe it would be at at Las Vegas or something like that. Anyway, so, but just before Jim was retiring, we knew we had to find a way to earn a living. And so I spent a lot of time while Jim was still playing looking for just the right property for something that would go along with his interests of outdoors and sports, and that would be a good place to raise our children. And so we decided that we would start a camp. So we started a day camp in Andover. It took a lot of looking, you know, and it was a perfectly, is that lady still here? She had to leave. One of our campers was here tonight. The location was ideal. It was in the Harold Parker State Forest, which boasted 2,900 acres. The campground was across the street from the property. There were three lakes or ponds, as they're called in New England, throughout the forest land. We could take the campers hiking through the woods and back up to our own 10 acres. We could give rowing lessons and canoe lessons, and it was a wonderful find. Layers of pine needles covered the ground, and all we had to do was build a pool, build the tennis courts, move into this 350-year-old house that was full of bats, and try and be ready for the opening day of camp. That camp, as a matter of fact, our son Jim is here, and our daughter-in-law Debbie. When we retired, they ran it and have been running it. It's been going for over 50 years now. So anyway, these are some pictures of, you know, when we started it, our little brochure, someone drew them for us. And we had a lot of volunteers who came, a lot of church groups and YMCA that tore down the lower branches of the pine trees. People volunteered in those days. And we used to just make cocoa and hot dogs and things, you know, and it was a very communal effort. Anyway, Jim also was coaching at Boston State College, where he had taken a job, and I thought, oh, good. I love to collect antiques, and when they go through all these little New England towns, I can go along. Well, Red Auerbach would never let us go on a road trip, and guess what? Turned out my husband was like Red Auerbach. There were no wives that were going on any road trip through any cute little New England towns to go antiquing. So, but all of that time, I was very busy, involved with, you know, picking up my husband at the airport, making sure he had. They had a pre-game meal at 3 o'clock that was always the same, baked potato, steak, like, ah. And so fine, and I was so frustrated because I wanted to do my art. And then suddenly I was now involved in this camp, but I was able to at least put my stamp into it. I made sure there were a lot of creative programs as well as competitive ones. And then I finally started working in Boston. Well, I volunteered at an organization called the Copley Society. It was the oldest art organization in Boston, and I eventually became director. I created a lot of new programs, and I planned the 100th anniversary, complete with a catalog, and it was a very interesting job, and I loved it, except I still couldn't do my own work. Then one day, an artist called Jason Berger came in with to discuss a trip he was taking to France. He was going to be taking a group of students to paint there, and he had one more opening. I said, oh, really? Gee, I might know somebody that would like to go on that trip. And I went home and talked to Jim about it, who of course said no. Jim says no about most everything. And then, after years, I learned how to, you know, work him into saying yes. But sometimes I just didn't even ask him anymore, which is My son is kind of nodding. Anyway, so I went to France with this group of young people, and it was just wonderful. And I knew I could not go back to just being in Boston, commuting every day, and working with other people's art. I had to start doing my own. So I gave my notice, and then I was driving to... we had bought a little place in Rockport. We thought we couldn't afford it. It was just, we paid $20,000 for this little shack, and we would go there on weekends, because when you live where, like at our camp where we did, you're always in the middle of your business, and somebody would be coming looking for their kids' underwear, or, you know, it was like, what? So anyway, I... was driving to Rockport, but that did, well, this day I came, as everyone says, there's the front road, and there's the back road, and there's the middle road. I was on the back road, going through Lanesville, and every time, and it's, I still feel that way when I drive over that bridge, I can start to relax. I bet it's the same for all of you. Suddenly, you know, the air is fresher, the people are nicer, the flowers are prettier, and you start to just, you know, unwind. So I was driving along that back road, and I came to a boarded up house, shack actually, that at one time, long ago, had been an artist studio. I thought, is it possible? So anyway, I... They couldn't have water because there was a problem with the sewer and so on. So our son Jim and a friend of his helped, and we ended up getting a permit so that I could open that little studio, which is still over there. Well, I've had it now, I think, I don't know, 25 or 30 years. People say, when are you going to be there? There's a sign that says, you know, come at... by chance or call or something. Well, good luck. Never find me. I'm actually more of an outdoor painter. In fact, right here I say, every time I've driven over that span connecting the mainland with the island, I start to relax. So I've already told you that. But then as going through little Lanesville, which I happen to love, that crazy little town, there's a post office, which is only open in the morning, and according to a sign that's hung there, and it also has huge pots of geraniums in the window. I doubt there's another post office like that anywhere. The liquor store was next to the post office, and at lunchtime, many truck drivers are pulling in and out of parking spots because the store was the last package store before crossing the town line into Rockport, which had been dry for over 50 years. And as I approached the end of Lanesville, just before entering Rockport, I saw that boarded up building. And anyway, with a lot of help, as I said, from my son, and of course I didn't tell Jim about it for quite a while, I had a little studio. I was very fortunate. I traveled to paint in a lot of places with different art groups. And I wrote a couple of books on painting and traveling. Imagine that. And so I was able to finally get to Paris. I don't know, the picture's on the cover. And painted in Paris. And then is that the bell? No. Anyway, long story short, I was invited to teach on the Queen Elizabeth, a 30-day cruise to Cape Town. And my friend Marty Holmes, who often traveled with me and was my assistant, we were really excited. We were to leave from Southampton, England. Our ship was to travel along the African coast, and I was to teach on the days at sea. We had all of our travel shots. I gathered all of my paints and brushes and watercolor paper, and I thought I would need for the trip. The weather would be wonderful that year in September of 2001. Then September 11th happened, and the world changed, and the tragedy stunned the world. I don't know. When you want to give me the hook, just tell me. But I just want to tell you about, we did the trip anyway. Most of the Americans canceled, you know, because there was a lot of fear of this ship out in the middle of nowhere, and we didn't know what would happen after 9/11. And they changed the itinerary so that we went to different ports. And they would often, in each port, they'd have divers go under the ship to be sure that we weren't going to be toasted. But what was so interesting to me about that trip was we did, without having a lot of Americans, we had a lot of people who spoke all different languages. And so I was to teach in a room that was held 20 people. First day we had 20 people. Next day we had 25 and they're out in the hall. Next day we had 40 and they moved me to the Queen's ballroom. Then we had 60 and the people were, you know, sitting around the periphery watching, and now I'm up on the stage with a microphone. And we ran out of supplies, but people had to share, and they didn't, you know, we had Oriental people, we had a lot of German people. They were sharing their supplies, but it was more than that. They needed to be close to each other. There was this feeling of warmth and humanity, and everybody needed it. And we ran out of supplies. We had to stop in little tiny towns along Africa, the African coast, and since they changed the itinerary, they were tiny little towns. So we had the crew, including the assistant captain and everybody, out looking for supplies, because now I had the biggest audience in this room, you know, not only painting and sharing whatever they could do, but, you know, watching. And so that was my first teaching experience on a cruise ship. And then I did teach for about 12 more years and loved it, and, you know, was able to travel all over the world with my paints. And so, well, I talk a lot about the other wives because we became such good friends, and we still are. And part of the reason that we were so close was because we had that dictatorial coach that was always giving us a hard time. But anyway, I did have an interview with Red, and I talk about it, you know, all the questions I wanted to ask him, and he said, and he answered me with a lot of nice pat things. I wanted to ask him so many things. Why was there supposed to be no sex on the day of the game? I still want to know that. Why had he not played Jim on the day of his retirement celebration? Why was he always so rude to us wives? Why couldn't we go on road trips? How would he compare the players of today with the teams that Jim played on? Actually, as I thought about it, if he hadn't been so gruff on the first day that Jim and I went there, Jim probably wouldn't have signed, because we were afraid, we had heard about all the trading and all that sort of thing. Anyway, it was a roller coaster, and some of it was crazy, some of it was wild, but it was a great ride. It was worth it. And then Red, of course, you know, I asked him if he'd write. I didn't dare ask him. What I really wanted to ask him was, why didn't you play Jim for even 2 minutes when he retired? But I knew the answer. Red always had to be in control. He always was a control freak. But anyway, so then with the wives, I have a little chapter somewhere that I won't even bother finding, but we found out that we were second string wives. Almost every one of the ball players met someone else on the road while the wife was home making the baked potato, the steak, and, you know, the pre-game meal. And they were divorced and married these ladies that they met on the road. Except me. Jeez. No, there are a couple of us that, you know, hung on. Anyway, I finally did go to Boston in November, and I raised my hat to Red because, after all, he was considered the most talented coach of all times, the most, you know, what he had accomplished. So I guess I had to take my hat off and recognize him. And our camp is still going. We're proud of our family. And as a matter of fact, we're in there, somewhere on the last page, there's a huge picture of this family that grew into, like, well, anyway, you'll see it. So why did I finish writing this book? I don't know. I think about it sometimes, but I guess I just had to. But I, you know, miss painting as much as I'd like to, and I hope to get back to it. And there's a painting in the back of the room. It's a story, another kind of a, well, not a memoir, but a story. It's a painted story of my mother. Those are all, it's all the history of her. She was a violinist, and so if you have a chance, maybe you look at it, you know. It was all about her, you know, playing and the things that she had to do. Anyway, this has been my pleasure. I couldn't be more thrilled to see you, those of you who are here. This is a perfect audience. And I guess, unless you have any questions, I didn't even cough. How about that? Yeah.